for these days.
Thank you.
More potential.
Thank you.
Using the backbone?
Yes, I will be using the backbone. So, so I'd like to thank first Adrian and Slava for the invitation in Toronto. It's very nice to be here and for giving me the opportunity to give a talk. So the title is maybe a little bit pompous, but what I want to show is to give an illustration of how some ideas coming from micro-local analysis can be applied to some partial data problems in sort of a limited sense. But, and I should first say that I will be mainly speaking about a work with Carlos Koenig, Johannes Sjöstrand, and Gunter Ullmann on the linearized calderon or on a linearized inverse problem. And also, I might say a few things about a coming work with Pedro Caro and Alberto Ruiz, where we are interested in getting stability estimates for the partial data problem corresponding to the results obtained by Koenig, Sjöstrand, and Ullmann. So first of all, I mean, there will be mainly two parts in the talk. First, sort of introductory part on the watermelon theorem. And I will be speaking about very classical things, but I think it's a good way to introduce what the watermelon theorem is. And what kind of results you can get directly using ideas coming from the watermelon theorem. And then I'll be speaking about the linearized problem. With partial data. So what is the watermelon theorem? It's a theorem which is due to Kashiwara, and so it's a way of describing the micro-locally, the analytic singularities of a function or a distribution which is supported on one on half plane. So in order to do so, I will say a few words about what the analytic wavefront set is. And in order to define the analytic wavefront set, I will first speak about the Segal-Bargmann transform, which is also known as the SBI transform. And I guess since this is shorter, this is what the name I will be using in the rest of the talk. So to make it simple, I'm just going to define it as, let's say, an L infinity function on some in Rn with compact support. And of course, you can make sense of that for compactly supported distributions and then extend the analysis to distributions. So it's just the following transform where you have a Gaussian kernel and it's depending on a small parameter h. So z here is a complex number, and the real part I will denote x and the imaginary part psi. And it's a sort of way of seeing the a complex phase space just as a complex setting. And of course, I mean, you can compute that, and you can see also that this is related to what people tend to call the wave packet transform. So there are many names for this, for this family of transforms. Okay. So now there's of course a very easy bound on the SPI transform of a function. So you immediately see here that there's some exponential growth coming from the fact that you're using a complex vector here. So the bound that you get is of course getting rid of this exponential increase. And I guess what you obtain if you just plug in the absolute value, I mean the oscillating term disappears. If you have an L infinity function here, you just have the L infinity norm of my function. And from the Gaussian, you get, well, I'm some constant, which H n over 2. So this sort of trivial bound that you get from the SPI transform. So I'm going to define now the analytic wavefront set, and so this is so it's easier, of course, to as always in microlocal analysis to define the complement of the analytic wavefront set, and the complement of this set is the set of covectors, or where you have a better decay, namely an exponential decay on this transform. So I will say that F is microlocally exponentially small at some point x0, xi0 in the phase space. If there exists a neighborhood of this point in the complex setting, so such that instead of having this bound, you have a much better bound, which is exponential decay. And this is for all h in 0, 1, and for all v in the neighborhood of z0. So the micro support of F is the complement of the set where this is where a function is microlocally exponentially small, and so I will denote it by mu of F is the set is the complement. So the wavefront set is just the part of the microsupport where the psi cannot be zero. So you see that if here psi zero is close to zero, well, what you get here, if you think that psi is zero here, what you get is some Gaussian transform of f, and when you let h tend to zero, it will converge to f of x. So if this is exponentially decaying, then this, when you let h tend to zero, this will tend to zero. So there are two parts in the micro support. One is the part where you're close to psi zero equals zero, and this is just, as I said, related to the support of the function f cross zero, and then another part, which is the set where, of course, the psi zero cannot be zero, and this denoted is the analytic wavefront set. And the analytic wavefront set is a way to describe analytic singularities of the distribution, and one way of seeing that is that if you project, so if I denote by pi the projection of the phase space, yeah, and I should have put probably some... and a bit less clear. So if you look at the projection of the analytic wavefront set of F, this is just the analytic singular support of F. So that means those points at which you cannot find a neighborhood where you can extend the function into an analytic function. So the SDI transform is a way of sort of analyzing the analytic singularities of a function or a distribution. And you see also that if I extend this analysis to the micro support, then I have also some information on the support of the function, which is contained in the set where I have some exponential decay or not of this FDI transform. Okay, so Kashiwara's watermelon theorem is the following thing. So I will suppose now that I have a priori assumption on the support of the function. So let's say that you have a hyperplane H0, and okay, and I will take eventually a point there in X0, in H0, and nu 0 is just the normal to my hyperplane, and I suppose that F is, so I have some a priori assumption on F, that it is 0 on one side of the hyperplane. Well, then obviously, this function, if x0 is in the support of f, this function cannot be analytic at x0 because it's supported on one side. So there are points in the analytic wavefront set, and there's a micro-local version of Holmgren theorem which tells you that actually you know that x0, nu 0 is going to be in the analytic wavefront set of the function. So one way of obtaining Holmgren's micro-local version of Holmgren's theorem is using Kashiwara's watermelon theorem, which is the following. So suppose that F is, okay, so let me keep, of course this is valid for a distribution, but since I have, for simplicity, I'm working with compactly support L infinity function. Let me keep this in the statement of the theorem. Is supported on one side of H0. Then, if I can find some point which is already in the analytic or in the micro support, let's say, the analytic micro support of the function f, then I have a lot of them, meaning that I can translate in the direction given by the normal to the hyperplane. And this is for all t. So So in particular, what I was saying is that as a consequence, you get the following fact. So if x0 is in the support of f, as I said, x0 cannot be in the analytic wavefront, in the analytic, so x0 is in the singular support of f. Therefore, you know that there's some point xi0 such that x0 xi0 is in the, let's say, in the analytic wavefront set of f. And then you obtain that all such points are also in the are in the micro support, and if you manage, I mean, if you're sure that this is non-zero, then you have something in the analytic wavefront set. There's something I should have said, is that this analytic wavefront set is a conic set. So actually what you get is that you can take out the T here. This is just using the watermelon theorem and the fact that you are dealing with a conic set. And then it is also a closed set. So I can take T to go to infinity, and what I obtain is that, as I said, x0 nu0 is in the analytic wavefront set of S. So this can actually be used to prove unique continuation theorems. In particular, there's a complete microlocal proof of Holmgren's theorem along those lines. So maybe before going to that point, I'm just going to make the following remark, is that I have already a unique continuation statement from the watermelon theorem, and let me write it there. So if I know that the support is on one side of the hyperplane, let me put a minus to say that it's on maybe on this side here. So I'm saying zero there. Yeah. And if I know that if I have this information, then I immediately deduce that x0 is not in the support of f. So this tells you that if you have an information on the support plus some sort of regularity assumption, then it tells you immediately that x0 is not in the support. And this you can see it here immediately, because you just take, here if you have nu0, you just take t to be minus 1. So you get something which is x0, 0. It tells you something about the support. Okay, and this can be used for instance to prove Holmgren's theorem. Because you just need to prove this statement, and this you can obtain by using some results, some elliptic regularity results on the wavefront set. But let me not go into more in this direction, but show you how you can also obtain some local uniqueness for the Radon transform. So this is... Okay, so I think if I could draw well, is because you're... You look at the wavefront set as a subset of the sphere, and then you have some point which is in the analytic wavefront set, and if you draw what happens when you're changing in one direction, it cuts out a slice. So the watermelon is just a sphere. So, and it cuts here, so with a slice cut. Yeah, so as I said, you can also obtain local or weaker version of Helgeson's support theorem. Okay. The reason I'm mentioning this is because although it may seem that this is a qualitative argument, you can make it quantitative, and this is the basis for the stability estimates that we are obtaining with Caro and Ruiz. And this has to do because when you look at the Calderon problem with partial data, there are mainly two steps. One step is the construction by complex geometrical optics, and it's not too complicated to obtain stability estimates for this part. And what you obtain in the partial data case is some information on some radon transform in certain directions. So in the uniqueness at the end, if you want to finish the argument, you need to have some version of Helgeson's support theorem where you're controlling the direction that you really need. And this you can obtain by using this watermelon argument, which I'm going to show you in a moment. And then you can have sort of quantitative version of this result. Okay, so in order to do that, of course, I'm going to cheat a little bit because I'm just going to put another microlocal version, which is what I'm calling microlocal Helgeson's theorem. And this is not too difficult to prove. You just need to make a relation between the radon transform and the FBI transform, and at least in odds dimension, this is not too complicated. So to obtain, for instance, this exponential decay for some information on the radon transform, it is not too complicated because you have a direct formula relating the FBI transform and the radon transform. So the microlocal version of Helgeson's theorem is the following, is that suppose you have an infinity function which is compactly support. And of course, I mean, the original Helgeson's theorem is valid for non-compactly supported functions. So there, if you really want a microlocal proof, there's some additional things that you need to do. But let's say for compactly supported functions, it's a little bit easier. So the statement is the following, is that if you know that the radon transform of H, so this is just I'm integrating over some hyperplane and then putting the corresponding measure, is zero for all H in a neighborhood of some given hyperplane, then you have some result on the regularity, and namely that if you look at points which are in the conormal to H0, well, they do not belong to the analytic wavefront set. X0 is in H0, and U0 is normal to H0. So you immediately see that if you have some a priori information on the fact that it's zero on one side of a hyperplane, then you know that it vanishes close to X0. Yeah, so let me make maybe a picture. So the information you have is you start. You know that somehow the support of the function is somewhere there. So you start with a hyperplane here. So you know that F is zero on this side. And you know also that the radon transform is zero for hyperplanes which are in the neighborhood. So meaning that I can vary a little bit the normal direction and also a little bit the distance to some fixed point. Well, then, what I know is that it will be zero somewhere there. So that means that if you already know that the function is compactly supported, you can start somewhere, And if you control enough directions, well, then you can push the argument. Okay? And so, in particular, you can obtain Helgeson support theorem, but other theorem, for instance, you can see that if you can sweep the support here by a family of hyperplane, then you can continue this argument when sweeping with E. So you don't really need all the directions somehow. So you can sort of keep control of the directions. And the other thing is that you can make it this argument a little bit quantitative. So in the sense that you're working on estimates, so you can keep track of the estimates. So let me give a very short idea of how the proof goes. So the main thing to understand about this Kashiwara watermelon theorem is that, so let me take maybe the dimension to be 1, because it's just going to be much, well, maybe not for my first statement, but after I go. So let me take H0 to be X1 equals 0, and I know that the function f is supported in X1 negative. So the first point is you gain a little bit of exponential decay on the FDI transform, so you just compute what I did before. So you have this quantity here. Okay, I think I erased. So I'm just going to develop the square. So I'm going to put to do a very crude estimate, and then I want just to develop the square in the x1 direction. So this is what you will get. And yeah, there's something missing. This would be too good. Yeah, it's the mixed term, sorry, no 2 and an H here. Okay, and of course here, I mean, this is very important that this is uniform with respect to H.
For trivial correction, and also with the X prime minus Y prime.
Yeah. So this, the function F is supported on the set where y1 is negative. So whenever x1 is negative, this is bounded by 1. So you get exponential decay in some... this is what you get. And then the usual, I guess, hn over. Or maybe n minus 1, n over 2 again. Yeah, so now let me work just in the one-dimensional case. So what you do is exactly the argument I will sketch just in the normal direction. So you just freeze the other variables and you just do this argument. So, sketch or idea proof, I will not to go into detail. So let me draw, this is psi1 and x1. So what you have is, this is x1 negative and this is x1 positive. So on one side you have a little bit of exponential, so in x1 negative you just have the usual bound, so this is the bound you get on this function. This is just like O of h n over 2. Here you gain a little bit more. And also, you're starting with the information that... so the watermelon theorem, you can always... is a statement about being in the wavefront set, of course, just by contradiction or by... you can just make it as a statement on not being on the wavefront set. So So what you have to prove is that if x0, nu0 is not in the analytic waveform set of the function, then this is also true on all the micro supports. But, well, same thing here, I guess. Then this is also true, not true here. Sorry. So if I work on this function now, so what you have is some information about some exponential decay here on some point. So let's suppose that you have, I don't know, psi 0 equals 0. You can always translate things. So what you have some information is about the fact that you have exponential decay here. And what you want to obtain is to obtain information on the exponential decay in some other points on this axis. So maybe with a smaller neighborhood. And of course, if you want information about the support, what you're really interested is to go get into this point there. So the idea of the proof is it's based on the maximal theorem. So you look at the following function, f of s. Well, you take the log, because what you want is not work with exponential bounds, but rather usual bounds. And this is s now is going to be a complex variable. And I guess it's just x0 psi 0 plus s. Nu0, you have to think, is the direction given by the one direction. So I guess just se1 and some absolute value, you multiply by h in order to have some uniform bound, and then you use the fact that you have some, that you can add some function which is just going to be, if I put it on the other side, I have x1 square over 2 minus psi1 square over 2. So this is a harmonic function. And this is a subharmonic function because this is holomorphic and you're taking the log of the absolute value of a holomorphic function, so this is subharmonic. So now it's just a statement of looking at the bounds that you get on this function. So you have something here, you can bound it by minus c, and you want to obtain estimate there. So what you can do is work on this half plane, and you have to shift it a little bit here. So you're working on this half plane, and it's just a question of building a proper majorant, harmonic majorant of this function. So this can be done actually quite explicitly. And then you have to prove that the majorant remains positive there, and this is true if you take delta small enough. So the thing is, if you look at this statement, it's like a sort of extrapolation of exponential decay in some direction. So this is what it really tells you, is you have some exponential decay of a certain function which is holomorphic, then you can extrapolate it to other directions. Yeah, and I think it's time to... So this is the type of idea that you can use in the linearized Calderon problem. And as I said, you can make this also quite quantitative, because you can, I mean, since the measurement is quite explicit, you can really follow how the constants are evolving. So the linearized Calderon problem with partial matter. And in fact, so what we really prove is rather a local problem, a partial data problem on the Schrödinger equation. Some of the reduction, I think, so probably you need some additional geometric assumption in the case where you're really dealing with the Calderon problem. So let me rather speak about the inverse problem on the Schrödinger equation. So this is in Rn. And so you're looking at solutions of the Schrödinger equation. And this Dirichlet problem, and probably if you want to solve it, there's some spectral assumption that zero is not a Dirichlet eigenvalue of this operator. Okay, so under this assumption, you can define the Dirichlet to Neumann map, depending on Q, which to F sends the normal, the Neumann boundary condition of the solution of your equation. So now, what is the Calderon problem? Is of course, and Nico has been talking of this last week in the anisotropic setting, is that if you have lambda q1 equals lambda q2, you want to deduce that the potential are equal. And now the local or the version with partial data is in the case where only partial data is available. So that would be that, for instance, if you know that the Dirichlet to Neumann map are equal in some part of the boundary, and maybe even your testing functions are in some other part, then Q1 equal Q2. So this is quite a challenging problem. So in dimension 2, this was solved by Imanuvilov, Gunther and Yamamoto. And in dimension n bigger than 3, there are some good results by Kenning, Sjöstrand and Ullmann, but in this degree of generality is still, I think, open. You have some, so there's some relation in their paper between gamma and gamma tilde, and also some geometric assumptions on the type of open sets that you can look at. So we got interested in the local version of this problem. So if you look at another formulation, or this would come out as the result of the following density problem. By the Green formula, it is easy to compute this function here, and this is lambda q1 minus lambda q2, u1 u2 on the boundary. So this is zero, and this is okay. This is true for solutions of the, of course, for solutions of the Schrödinger equation. And this can be taken to be zero if u1 and u2 are supported. Okay, and let me take same. Okay, so you can sort of deduce the answer to the Calderon problem with partial data as a result of densities. You have to show that the product of solutions of the Schrödinger equation with some constraint on the support on the boundary is dense in some functional space depending on the, so in L1, I guess, if Q1 and Q2 are an infinity function. So the linearized version of that is a similar density argument, which is the following, is that then you want Q1 minus Q2, or maybe some potential Q here, U1, U2, to to be zero, but for harmonic functions with a support constraint. And gamma, also you would like, I mean, the best case gamma to be small. Okay, so this is the linearized version. So in the case of the full data problem, it's just the density of product of harmonic functions. And this, there's a very straightforward answer, is that you're taking, so in the full data case, and this is, was an observation and has been very useful in the study of the problem by Calderon, is that you can take U1 and U2 to be harmonic exponentials. Okay, so if you want these exponentials to be harmonic, if you apply the Laplacian, what you will get is zeta1 squared times this exponential. So the only way to have harmonic functions is to suppose that zeta j square equals zero, and of course, therefore, to work with the complex vectors. And that means that the real part and the imaginary part have same norm and are orthogonal. So now you see that this is not as simple if you put some support condition, because obviously this is not zero in part of the boundary. So this is why it gets a little bit more complicated in this case. So let me just take a few words about the some references that I have already given. A very brief list. Of course, I mean, the Calderon problem has been studied very extensively, so I can mention the seminal paper of Calderon, where this question was posed for L infinity conductivities, and the linearized problem was studied. So maybe I can just say a few things about the full data case. So I guess then the first results were of Kohn and Vogelius, which showed the boundary determination and were able to tackle analytic conductivities. And then, I guess, work of Sylvester and Ullmann in dimension bigger than 3, where they complemented the construction of those harmonic exponential using complex geometrical optics. And this has given, in dimension n bigger than 3, a lot of a way of attacking the problem. And then there's the result of Nachman in dimension 2. And then I guess so there's a final answer with a degree of regularity posed by Calderon, that is for infinity conductivity by Astella and Pajarinta. So I would say that in 2D, I think now the problem is, there's a better understanding of the problem. It's higher dimension, but both from the perspective of anisotropic problems and also from partial data, this is a little bit more, less understood. So there's a first result of Buchheim. And I'm sorry, I hope I won't make mistakes. And Ullmann, where they were able in dimension n bigger than 3 to deal with this problem. I think here is the full boundary, and on the gamma is large, meaning that if you look at a ball, it would be half of the sphere that you would need. And then there is this paper of Kenny Chestron and Ullmann, where they were able to remove this, I mean, to consider small subsets of the of the of the boundary. But here, I mean, this gamma, okay, and let's forget about, just put the full boundary here on the test functions. But there are still geometric constraints on the open set. So it would give a total answer for convex subsets. And for non-convex subsets, there are some assumptions, or it could be that the part where you're measuring is bigger. Okay, and then, this is something I should have put here in 2008. So these were results, there was a result by Buchheim on the Schrödinger problem in 2D, which was still open. And the sort of idea introduced by Buchheim allowed Imanovilov Ullmann and Yamamoto to deal with the 2D partial data problem. And there, I guess, a lot of is known now, even in the context of Riemann surfaces, the work of Guillermo and Su, and also for more general operators. And I should mention also that Kenichi-san and Ullmann and myself worked with the with a case of the Schrödinger equation with magnetic potential, and in particular there was a reduction to this argument using the Radon transform, which was done, let's say, in a more direct but maybe a little bit more intricate way by Kenichi-san and Ullmann. So the theorem is exactly this one. We can tackle the linearized problem, and we have a lot of trouble dealing with a nonlinear problem. So the theorem is indeed the set of products of harmonic functions which vanish on gamma, and gamma is any neighborhood of a given point on the boundary, so it can be very small. Is dense in L1. Okay, so there's a first reduction which I'm not going to talk about, which is the following thing. Is that so the starting point is exactly this one. You have Q times U1, U2, Ex, which is zero for harmonic functions, and they should vanish in this part of the boundary. And vanish, sorry, if you say vanish, this is pretty, I want this to be big. I'm tricking myself because I'm always writing this, so which are supported on. So of course I want the constraint to be so I want them to be supported on a small subset of the boundary and vanish in a big subset of the boundary. So this is what I need to prove, that Q is zero. So there's a first reduction which is
on
omega. No, Q is zero everywhere. Yeah, thank you. Maybe. Yeah, thank you. So the first reduction is actually you just need to get a little bit insight. So what I will prove is that what I try to prove is, I mean, the proof goes this way, is that, so you have an omega like that, and this is the point y zero of the boundary. This is my gamma. And then if you can show that Q is zero there, then it is enough. And the argument is like a unique continuation argument. You get a little bit inside, you change your omega, and then you have to prove that somehow when you're changing your omega, you're keeping the information that this integral is zero. And then you go up inside. So there are some computations to do, but this is sort of, the key argument is really reduced to a local uniqueness result. Okay. So what are the functions that we are going to use? Well, we are going to use exactly the exponentials, but of course you have to correct them with a correction which takes care of the support on the boundary. So I'm going to look at exponential. And I'm putting a small parameter h, because this will eventually come out in the FBI transform. And zeta square equals zero. And then, of course, I need to correct this. So these are going to be my uj's. And I guess I'm just skipping the j. And the w, the w, of course, has to be a harmonic function. And you wanted to correct the other one, so you want it to be equal to some cutoff times the original one. Where, I guess, so you want chi to be 1 on the complement of gamma. And maybe you want to do this on a slightly bigger, or let me be a little bit uncautious and just say that gamma, that chi is 1 on the complement of gamma. And then it's supported away from gamma. So the first thing is you can really reduce to such a situation by a conformal transformation. You can make sure that you're indeed in the situation where your point y0 is just zero. The omega is on one side of the tangent hyperplane, and this is the x1 direction. Okay, and this is the x prime direction. So that you can achieve by doing a conformal transformation, just to be sure that the set is on one side of its tangent plane. And now, of course, you have to estimate what your the proof goes, of course, you're going to multiply the two. So the exponential part is good because it gives you like a sort of Fourier transform in the complex with complex variables. But then you have to control what happens with the W's. And what happens is actually, since the W's are supported away from this point, is you can actually get exponential decay in some direction, provided you put some conditions on zeta. So maybe I can write what I have. Okay, so what you can get is exactly what I'm saying. So you do some computation. Of course, I mean, there's some polynomial behavior in zeta, but this is not important. I mean, everything is related to the exponential decay. So what you get is that this is what you get. So you just look at that, and then the imaginary parts, and the, of course, you're supported in x1 negative, and of course the chi function is 1 somewhere there, and you can cut it to be 0 maybe there. So The W is supported away from that. The W is supported in something like that. Okay, so this is the exponential decay you get, and of course you cannot control the other direction, so there's some constant. Let me write it 1, but you can always, or maybe some big constant here. In the other direction, and this is true if the imaginary of zeta is positive. Okay, so now you just plug your solutions there. So what you obtain is, yeah, I need to more or less finish there. What you obtain is some information on the exponential decay of some Fourier transform. This is what you'll get. So here you have your Fourier transform. And this has some exponential decay. So let me forget about this behavior there and just write the in terms of the exponential decay. So what you get is something like that. And of course you have the worst possible. And then of course in the other direction you cannot control what happens. Ah, these are bad notations. I need to put. So the 1 means the first direction. Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Okay, so what you'll get is certain, so you have to remember also that zeta square equals 0 and eta square equals 0. So in 2 dimension, this is actually, it's just the union of 2 complex lines generated by 2 vectors. One is 1 plus, okay, let me, how did I write this? Well, I guess it's just 1, so into E, and then of course 1 minus E. So you can, and this is a basis of course of C2, so you can reconstruct a lot of frequency by that, provided that of course there's this condition that this should be strictly positive and this should not be too big. So what you get is some exponential decay of the Fourier transform in some conic direction, which is the sum of the 2 direction there. Okay, so you see exactly that you are at the point where you have, of course, I mean, the ideal situation would be in the case where you would get all direction, because then you would get some information on the some exponential decay of the Fourier transform, and then you could conclude by the Pei-Levinner theorem. So here you're in a situation where, unfortunately, you don't get all the direction because of the constraint that, of course, this has to be positive, and that this decomposition actually, I mean, higher dimension also is only close to some direction. So it's exactly the situation where you want to extrapolate some exponential decay to a bigger set of frequencies. And so this can be done exactly using the type of ideas I have given before. And the reason is, of course, you can relate the FBI transform with the complex Fourier transform, and then you can just repeat this argument, which is slightly, I mean, the picture is slightly different than the one I have drawn because the directions are not equal, exactly the same, but you can just finish the argument in the same way that they have shown you how to prove the watermelon theorem. And once you get that, you get some exponential decay on the FBI transform, and then it gives you information on the support. So you can just get that the function is zero close to the close to the point y0. And I think I'll finish here. I'm already ahead of time. Thank you.
Could you elaborate a little on continuing once you have passed from omega to something slightly smaller?
Yeah.
Because of course it's not immediately.
No. It's not clear. You have to do some,
there's
a density argument which comes in, where you have to prove that somehow, I mean, the harmonic functions on your new set, you can relate them to the information that you have on this integral. So it's not a straightforward argument. Yeah, there's some work to do. And also, something I should say is that this works for the linear scales because we are using this maximal theorem, so we'll be using, of course, analyticity with respect to the spectral, I mean, to the Z in the FBI picture, but of course it relates to the complex frequency of the complex geometrical optics. In the nonlinear problem, the analog of these exponentials, which are known, are not analytic, and this is, of course, cause a lot of trouble and explains why this argument does not, for the time being, does not work in the nonlinear setting. So for the actual Calderon problem.
Could one linearize around a real analytic initial setting rather than linearizing around?
I'm not sure that this is enough because the kind of solutions that you the type of solutions that you get, I mean, it is not known whether you can have them analytic or not. So, and the main part is that, I mean, the complex geometrical optics, of course, you can construct, you can construct a complex, WKB expansion which is analytic, but it is then, when you want to add the correction term to have an exact solution. And this is done by several techniques. One of them is using Kalman estimates, but you don't control the regularity. And the other is there are some unique explicit solutions, and there you know it is known that they satisfy some D-bar equation. So. Yeah. Well, then the first step is you have to have some analyticity somewhere. So you have to work with analytic metrics. And then, well, then it could be that you can work. I mean, so that would be the case where you have. Oh, no, and sorry. So you're interested in what? In the full data problem or some version of the partial? Well, yeah, what geometry you're putting on the. So if the manifold is non-simple, we haven't been able to solve this problem. So, I mean, even that direction that's interesting to see the full data problem. Supposing that the metric is analytic, but that the conformal factor or the potential is not. Is just not. Yeah. 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 No, it's simple. I mean, okay, and now you're thinking about the partial data problem. Okay, so I mean, we don't know how to do it for the flat case. So are you thinking about some linearized version of the? Okay, that could be that you can make this work. Yeah. No. Okay. Then there's yeah. If you assume that the metric is analytic, but then probably you have already results in that direction on the nonlinear problem. Yeah. Okay. Well, but the Euclidean, I mean, the Euclidean direction is also analytic, so you prove. Yeah, so, yeah, that would be, okay. A linearized version. But it's not clear that you don't get that directly by analyticity. Or I don't know. It's just, yeah. It seems that is possible because you're going to do the same kind of thing. You're using complex geometrical optics. If it's analytic, then, and you don't have to build this correction term for the nonlinear problem. So you can really use the, well, actually, even that is not completely clear. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, then thank you very much.
Thank you.